So I better get going here. Here's a photograph and a map by a remarkable person who's in the act of supposedly retiring, and I hope that Dick Miller does not retire. But in any event, one thing that I came across that was amazing to me was that this is a forest type without an inventory. For many years, this was judged to be a non-commercial woody forest ecosystem, and therefore was excluded from FIA. And FIA in the last couple of decades has expended quite a bit of effort to include it within the forests of the nation, and for good reason. But I would like to acknowledge, because embedded in my account here is some criticism, I would like to acknowledge the remarkable effort of the FIA people, field teams and data analysts, now over 60 years of work, and also a consulting agency who actually helped me get involved in this process very indirectly. And they made Utah's first estimate for forest carbon sink, of which the pinyon juniper accounts for quite a bit, mainly because of its area, not because of its rapid growth. But I'll try to tell a story within a story. And the big story has to do with carbon dioxide and its sources and sinks in the forest. And the smaller story involves me a little bit, but it definitely involves Utah and how Utah came to have policy interest in, of all things, forest carbon cycling. Well, 30 states now have carbon budgets, and they're really greenhouse gas budgets, and for good reason. And by and large, these are inventory, industrial inventories, transportation inventories, agricultural estimates of nitrous oxides, methane, and CO2. And accompanying them, because of the extensive nature of forest lands and the magnitude of carbon storage, we have estimates made of forest land sources and sinks, and by and large based on FIA data and modeling. Mainly this effort has been led by consulting firms. I don't know any professors who have been, or scientists, professional scientists. These are practicing well-educated people, but let me just say, they're at the fringes of peer review. I think that one of the conclusions I'll come to is, please go home, look to see if your state has a carbon or a greenhouse gas estimate, and look at the forest data, because they do matter quite a bit. And as you'll see in Utah, we swung on a pendulum where the first estimates were very much a huge fraction of the total emissions of greenhouse gases, and that pendulum swung to near zero. And that created an opportunity for an Easterner like me to be called up on the telephone by an old student and get involved in a state's greenhouse gas inventory. But more about that in a moment. So Utah contracted CCS, Center for Climatic Strategies, a company that's done probably 20 or up to 20, I say a dozen here, but I think it's up to 20 of the 30 or so greenhouse gas budgets of states. And this was their first results was that Utah had greenhouse gas emissions from industries, transportation, agricultural sector, about 66 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent per year. All well and good. And the embedded in the February 2007 report was that the forest land sink, which includes woodlands and pinyon juniper, as well as the intact and more commercial forest types, of almost 40 million metric tons. And a simple, innocent question was raised: this is a pretty dry state. That's a big number. That's a big fraction. So almost 60% of the emissions were offset by forest sinks in the first report, February 2007. An innocent question was raised. I was not involved in this. A good question. Go back and look at this. Excuse me. Go look at that. That fraction of the total, and they were given 6 months to re-estimate the forest carbon sink. And so what this group of folks apparently did was, instead of asking bigger questions, critical questions about FIA, they dug into the data even bigger, even more deeply. And they estimated carbon in live trees, in standing snags, coarse woody debris, litter, mineral soil, all from the FIA data and simulated results. And as a result, the forest carbon sink was revised downward quite considerably, down to a negative, I call sink a negative, 12 million metric tons equivalent. So it was reduced from about 60% to less than 20%. And here's what was done. The details of the carbon budget were estimated here, and I think that the result was even creating more questions and more uncertainty about what the heck the forests of Utah were doing. So we have biomass carbon sink of negative 4 million metric tons, the detrital carbon pools, forest floor plus coarse woody debris added up to about 8. This is a very curious forest, isn't it? And then the mineral soil organic carbon was accumulating even more faster at about 12. And so the total sink was estimated at 23. And at least in the records, it was a few phone calls were made. The soil organic carbon pool was pulled out of this due to, it says, considerable uncertainty in the report, and we landed up at 12. Well, that wasn't the only question, that soil organic carbon was thrown out because of uncertainty. That's quite interesting, but think about an ecosystem that grows biomass at, I think it's 20% of the amount that's accumulating, statewide also. That's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess it's conceivably possible, but quite curious. So here's where I entered into the picture. One benefit of being an aging scientist is that one accumulates an expanding network of colleagues and friends. And one of my former students, he was a mid-career student, turns out to be the Utah DEQ chief. And one thing led to another, and he just asked me an innocent question about what was going on here with his state and whether I could do anything. Well, at first I didn't want to do anything. I don't know much about Utah or dry land systems, in fact. But the more I looked at this, the more I figured, well, I can do better than had been done. And it was very interesting because I'm very interested in the FIA in my state and across the East and across the whole nation for that matter. And this particular situation was incredibly interesting. And I wonder about its generality. So if you look at the FIA reports for Utah, not unlike many other states, you have a periodic report issued, in this case 52, which was the first national survey, really, 61, 78, 93, and 2003, which is the ongoing survey online. And it certainly indicates that Utah's forest carbon sink, I think, might be best estimated, not by feeding this data into a computer model, but rather by stepping back and taking some upper and lower bounds of forest areas and rates of carbon sequestration, and that's what I decided to do. And along the way, I was very much convinced that I hadn't appreciated just how difficult FIA's charge is, and particularly in a state like this, which has not only intact forests, but an expanding woodland land base, which hadn't been inventoried prior to 1993. And then the more I thought about it, the more I'm struck by the issues that arise that FIA wasn't designed to estimate carbon, much less carbon below ground or in the component pools of an ecosystem. And that's quite interesting. And I wonder about the simulation models, forest CARB, that are used with our FIA data. And I was really struck by lining up these five or six reports by how the FIA reports, particularly for this state, but I'm sure it's generalizable to a number of states, don't tell a story so much about continuity of measurement as they do of change and about scientists and managers and professionals coping with difficult situations and gradually improving the inventory over time. That's what strikes me. And so a few particulars. The 1961 report is very interesting. It just simply outright dismisses the 52 survey as a non-statistical inventory. Don't believe it. The 1978 area and volume data are a great deviation to data both before and after, both the area and volume data. And so drawing lines through these points is hazardous business for sure. And even in 1993, the report strongly cautions against comparisons with all past inventories. And lastly are the two most recent inventories, which are doing their best to get a handle on the pinyon juniper, for example, over 10 million acres in the state. They're trying to do their best, and the sampling protocols have changed quite considerably between the two inventories. So unless you kind of dig into the details of your state's FIA past, it's hazardous territory. It's hazardous territory, to say the least, to get FIA on the phone and plug in the data or draw lines between points. So a little bit of overview of this remarkable state and its incredible forest land. It's extensive and over 15 million hectares statewide. Here's from the 78 report. It's diverse, contrasting forest ecosystems, and dynamic. It's hard to imagine, one sentence that stated, how dynamic forests have been and rangelands have been in the last century and a half. Major changes in the area of ecosystems, tree species, stand structures, as we've already seen in the pinyon juniper here today. So summarizing the 93 and 03 FIA data area, you can see that the state is dominated by the extensive woodlands on the left and by a whole diverse set of timberlands, the commercial intact forests on the right, that have been repeatedly inventoried over time. Aspen, spruce and fir, Douglas fir, ponderosa pine, white fir, and lodgepole pine. And historically, if we look at the woodlands side of the ledger, historic grazing, fire control, hypothetically climate change, have all contributed to this so-called March of the PJ, or what Helga calls the lignification of Utah. I like this, Helga. I wrote this in the paper and the reviewer didn't like that, and I pulled it out of my paper, and it's one of those things where you kick yourself in the butt. This is a great comment, I think a great little characterization, the lignification of the landscape. In any event, it was instructive to go back into the department at USDA census inventories and to accumulate the history of Utah in terms of their sheep numbers and cattle numbers, and to explore the emerging artistic form of re-photography of the American West. There are professors of different universities who specialize in re-photography. And here's just two photographs from the Klein Library, Northern Arizona. Only it's of the, I didn't give the mountain name in Utah. And then if you look at the woodland, if we look at the timberlands and their historical use in terms of logging, we have an equally interesting trajectory of change of use of the intact forests. And logging peaked post-World War II, mostly publicly held forest, national forest land, with sharp recent declines. And in very recent decades, many sawmills have been closed. It's a story that's pretty common in many states in the West. And this logging history has left a legacy of basically stand regeneration. And here's some age distribution from a report by O'Brien in 99 of the FIA data. You can see that many of the stands, about half of them are less than 100 years old. And this is not a J-shaped set of curves either. It's quite an interesting set of curves in which the most frequent stands are between 50 and 100 years old. And only the Engelmann spruce stands out on the left as a contrary to this pattern. So if you look at the, just look at the net annual growth information from 93 to 2003 and kind of use these data to get a sense of which way the wind has been blowing, maybe not today with the vast mortality sweeping across many of the systems, but in those two surveys, wood was accumulating in these timberland types in which stand plots were revisited, and only the true fir at that time stood as an exception to that accumulation of wood in forests of the timberlands, of the historic timberlands. So what I decided to do was to take the woodlands and estimate them separately from the timberlands, and here's a set of assumptions in which the area of the woodlands and the rate of carbon sequestration are taken together, and a lower and an upper bound are established, and I think that the lower and upper bounds represent to me very much the extreme and probably not the case so for example, a lower bound, a very low accumulation rate on a small fraction of the total of pinyon, 5 million hectares are said to be a grading. Those are those that are under 100 years old, and that 0.36 million tons of carbon per year are what are suggested to be the lower bound of accretion across the state for pinyon juniper. And it similarly, and probably unrealistically high, is the upper bound, where all 13 million hectares based on the 2003 FIA and a very high accumulation rate were used. So we got a lot of uncertainty here and a whole order of magnitude practically that separates the two ends. And we got some other assumptions in the middle. And I've just better or worse in this semi-quantitative analysis highlighted the median. And that's actually higher than the intact forests, which are arrayed in a similar manner with a lower and upper bound, and areas and rates of accretion are manipulated here in a set of boundary kind of calculations. Okay, so just to summarize and conclude, the estimated Utah forest carbon sink in CO2 units now has a median of such and the upper and a range of such. And so here we're talking about a median of about 10 million metric tons per year. One thing that's interesting is 50 to 70% of this forest sink comes from the pinyon juniper woodlands. This is somewhat lower than the second of the two CCS estimates, and the forest carbon sink, at least in this calculation, ranges from about 10 to 20% of Utah's entire emissions rather than the 20 to 60% that the CCS estimated. So maybe some broader conclusions. That the forest carbon sink is so clearly a product of historical land use and contemporary management. There are major uncertainties here about the future of this particular carbon that is accreting at whatever the rate is across the state. Wildfire risks, pest and disease complexes are developing and are even developing since that 2003 inventory. There are ecosystem grassland restoration projects that are aimed at the PJ and that prescribed such practices as not only mastication, but chaining. Who's heard of chaining, except if you live in the West? Chaining, you're gonna chain the forests. Oh my gosh, chaining the forests, where you drag chains across the landscape to alter the revegetation dynamics of the ecosystem, all funded by public funds. Somewhat funded by public funds, and the extent to which our management can intervene with such powerful historic forces, I think, is a good question to ask. And last but not least, I'll just end by saying, what has your state done in terms of its greenhouse gas inventory? We're all scientists. Take a look at your statewide estimate and look in the forest part of the ledger. It might be quite interesting. So thanks for your interest. I clearly need a drink. If I'm going to applaud at the end of my own talk. Yeah.
Something you might find interesting is during the Milford Flat wildfire,
yes,
that was discussed here earlier, chaining was actually done on post-fire to uh-huh. remove or knock down burn trees.
For aesthetics or why?
I have been asking that question ever yeah. since I heard that myself.
Uh-huh.
Does anyone really know the answer?
Well, that was we didn't hear it at all.
Repeat the question.
Oh, I know. After the Milford Flat wildfire, they actually chained the burned juniper. And if anyone can tell me why, I'd be pleased to know the answer.
One of the big things that they chained for is the seed, to cover the seed, because as they just throw it out, it's exposed, and if they find that they cover the seed, and fire success is established. We also looked at they along with pulling a chain, they weld rebar or big iron ties onto the chain. It's called an Ely chain, and that tills the soil, and that may break up water repellency too, and be one of the reasons why it could be successful. The Milford Flat Fire is very, a lot of areas they actually created a lot of wind erosion, so it wasn't too stable. I showed a picture.
A lot of chaining also was done for type conversions, for to convert chaparral, for example, to grass for grazing purposes, mm-hmm. and also to create field breaks.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, I understood those parts. It's just the post-fire ones that blew me away. I had a tough time swallowing.
Oh, we do all kinds of things. Here's a member of the wrong species, that's all.
So we're now in a question answer period, and I'd like to invite any questions that have occurred to anyone about presentations that were made to my colleagues this afternoon. And if not, I have one. I wondered about the post-fire wettable layer underneath canopies and how that forms. I'm not sure I remember the likes of Debano talking about that kind of thing. I remember the propagation of the hydrophobic layer following fire is quite well described by the historic scientists. But what's the wettable layer above that, even if it's shallow? How is that formed?
There's two things. One is in these juniper woodlands, they get quite a bit of litter that's accumulated mm-hmm. at the surface. And so that burns, and you have that ash there that's at the surface. But as well, and this is kind of standard in the literature, where all those organics, whether it be at the litter surface or whether the hydrophobic material in the soil, those hydrophobic compounds volatilize. They're heavier in air, so they go down into the soil, and then they condense back out on the cool underlying soil layers, and you end up getting that wettable.
Uh-huh.
It could be a more intense hydrophobic zone, or the fire could be hot enough that it can actually break up that part.
Yeah. Dale?
I was going to say, there's a footprint that's by exactly the same zone as the tile fire south of the Powell.
This
hydrophobic before the fire.
This is a canopy-related effect underneath the vegetative canopies of a fire ring.
One of the things you also see, too, depending on the total consumption of
might
litter,
want to speak up.
Depending on how much of the litter is actually consumed, you can have a fair amount of ash that's left behind, mm-hmm. depending on the wind or the convection and all this, that uh-huh. sort of thing. So there can be some ash left behind, or there could actually be a little bit of litter left behind that uh-huh. makes that very...
So the discussion is going to open a little bit, and we had a nitrogen and phosphorus symposium earlier in the day. and we had a series of speakers and only a little bit of discussion at the end. I can remind us here.
David,
Lindsay.
I think we'll maybe take a 5-10 minute break.
That sounds good too.
5-minute break. If people want to get a drink or a bathroom or whatever you want to do, and then we'll start the facilitating the booster session. But we'll also entertain questions about the group talks that we're doing. So,
let's gather together by 5:10. Sorry about that. I have no conflict of interest, of course. Pull me out of the running. That'll be better. But I actually wanted to...
Yeah.
Yes, Ron. All right. Okay, we're ready for the question answer period. Yes, indeed. Dear colleagues, that's what they say in Europe.
We were going to have them come on, like, maybe just this side and come
okay.
Forward if they can.
All righty. Professor Helga Van Meegret. Dean Michael Kelly. Professor Fernandez, right up front here. And Dan Markowitz, get your act in gear here. Please sit down. Okay, I'm gonna hand over the show to the two formal conveners here, Ron and Farah. Thank you. Thank you.
Good evening. Come as close as you can so we can have maybe a little bit more of an intimate discussion.
Maybe we can move the bar to the front. Does that help? I think that's a good idea. You want to move the bar to the front?
So we're going to talk a little bit about the poster session that went on this afternoon, and we'll just go through the posters at first and then maybe talk about some unifying themes in the session this afternoon. So...
Can we introduce the first one?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, this is a poster session discussion from, and we didn't have very many posters down there today, eight or so? And the first one was number 1421, and it was presented by Eric Jokola. Where's Eric? He's here somewhere. There he is. And Jason's out there. I saw him a minute ago. Jason Vogel. Where are you, Jason? In the back. Okay, good. And the title of their presentation, and I think you had a different title on the poster from what's in the program. Is that right?
We do that sometimes.
Do you? Okay. Well, as long as you do that, I would suggest you look on page, before we start on that, you look on page 108. And on page 108, there's session number 200-2. And check that one out and see if you can top that one for the title of a talk. Okay, apart from that, let's get back to it. The title was Micronutrient Limitations in Intensively Managed Southern Pine Plantations. Southern Pine Stands. And so, would anyone out there like to kick it off with some questions or comments on this particular poster? Who's that? Oh, Dan.
I wonder, Eric, generality of copper deficiency region-wide in your view, and boron deficiency region-wide, given your results?
Yeah. Good question. And the boron deficiency is people have talked about boron deficiency in the Southeast for a long time, but quite honestly, there's very little public data. Showing boron deficiency, except for the paper Earl Stone wrote in about 1983, when a sandy nursery was slashed by the boron. Copper is kind of a new beast. We documented manganese, Bill McBee and Earl Stone and I, in 1993 in manganese deficiency slash fiber. Copper is relatively new, and where we think it's probably more widespread would be on the sandy, very poorly drained soils, particularly the wetter end of the catena. And we have some higher organic. What the poster showed, we just had two sites, but there were two taxonomically similar soils. And just using a malic free extraction, they were quite different in terms of quote extractable copper and zinc. So all soils aren't created equal is part of the message. We don't really have a very broad perspective yet in terms of how widespread it is, but we do see that we induce it with intense
measures. I guess I was curious if from your point of view, working on micronutrients, whether you suspected that boron may be more extensively deficient across a bigger region than copper or not.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at a lot of foliar data, and it's not uncommon to find foliar levels 8 parts per million, or even less. In some of our sites with copper, it's not uncommon to find a lot of 3 parts per million kinds of concentrations. And in some of the sites where we've seen the expression, the phenotypic expression of deficiency, the lack of apical dominance, you're generally less than 2 parts per million. But how widespread it is, Dan, I think we're still learning.
I have a question for you, Dan. Would you mind explaining to the group why you bring up boron in relation to copper and not some other micronutrients? In other words, some folks here might not have the background for that particular part of the country and so on.
Well, it was determined by Eric and his colleagues' results, which showed that those were the two micronutrients that were the most deficient in their site. That was all it was.
Okay. All right. Good. Thanks. Any other questions or comments for Jason or Eric? Yes?
Yeah. I just had a question about your design.
Yeah.
It's an elaborate minus design, right?
Yes.
What other, how would you, if you were to replicate that elsewhere, look at the, would you consider that the same
kind of? Well, I mean, if we're working on SOTUSOLs, given some of the results, we probably wouldn't need all of the micronutrients, but we were really trying to, through the meat cutting stage, and trying to identify some soil that just has very poor growth. So we used a hypothesis really that with nitrogen was kind of driving these very rapidly growing sands, producing a lot of leaf area, and the micronutrients are diluting out the foliage. So we put on from 0 to 330 kilograms per hectare of head, and lo and behold, nitrogen really wasn't driving. So yeah, we probably use a more simplified design.
Mike?
And Eric was saying here, the common wisdom is that these are nitrogen-induced deficiencies. There's a lot of talk around that the boron deficiency is actually not induced. Eric's work is saying it's not, so I think it's an important contribution.
Okay. Farah had a question.
I have a question. So these are relatively intensely managed systems that you're working in.
Yes.
Do you think that a micronutrient limitation by copper, boron would be prevalent in less intensively managed systems than other regions?
Yeah, if you look at the agricultural literature, particularly in Florida, on what they classify as virgin sorbisols, it isn't uncommon in citrus and other row crops to see micronutrient deficiencies like copper. I don't think it would be necessarily expressed as readily, perhaps, in a low-intensity kind of a management system. but what kind of struck us was that, you know, those soils were pretty darn different in terms of the supply, or at least what we think is the supply of micronutrients, particularly with depth. We would think that perhaps the argillic horizon might be a pretty strong source of micronutrients. On one of our sorbisols, we definitely saw that, but the other one, not the case. So I think it's pretty much soil specific. In fact, wisdom would have told us that the one site that didn't respond to micronutrients is actually on an older terrace, and we would have thought from a weathering perspective that might have even been a higher probability of seeing a micronutrient. So it's, from my perspective, we're still kind of in our infancy in terms of understanding micronutrient supply needs in these stands and also the interaction. And we were showing what we think is a copper-zinc interaction, where zinc actually exacerbated the copper deficiency. And digging in the literature from 30 years ago of agriculture, that has been documented. They're competing for terms of root uptake, and it seems like zinc has a role to play here.
Others? Yes.
Okay.
Ivan?
We talked a little bit about your poster, but there was a pretty profound response relative to genetic material. Mm-hmm. And so the question is it a better option perhaps to work on the above ground side to address this rather than start to fertilize?
Well, what Ivan's getting at, that was a different study than the one I presented,
right.
But we had what appeared to be a genetic response to the copper deficiency. One of the families really just broke down and actually caused mortality, whereas the other one exhibited the deficiency but didn't show as strong an expression of deficiency. You know, I think if you go into these stands and you start seeing visual symptoms, yeah, it's probably time to think about prophylactic treatment. And some of our earlier work with micronutrients suggests that it's very conservatively cycled. It hangs around a long time. It doesn't take much. You know, 3-4 kilograms per hectare of copper probably all you need. So how much time you want to invest, isolating rates and so forth, if you suspect a problem, probably the best operation is to put something out. And I think I would caution folks to at least on our sites to think about exploring and better understanding the zinc interaction with copper.
Okay. Any other quick ones for Eric or Jason? I have one for you with regard to you had sites that were slash pine and loblolly pine. And from what I gathered from your poster, the main difference between those two sites was one on the slash pine was poorly drained soil and the other one was very poorly drained. You think that drainage class was enough to make a difference on those two sites? Or what other morphological or other kinds of characteristics might you suggest could be significant?
Yeah, I would say drainage certainly would create a stronger, in this case, copper deficiency, but mineralogically, those soils seem to be different in terms of supply. So I'd probably examine that with probably more earnest than simply try to isolate based on half a drainage class.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the literature would suggest that once you get into more poorly drained soils with higher organic matter, that you might expect
bigger problems with copper, and that's been documented in a lot of places.
Okay, good. Well, we should move on to our next poster then, and I'll continue it up here for just a bit. And the next poster was presented by Don Ross and Scott Bailey. Where are you? Out here somewhere? Well, we'll have some good discussion on this then. And the poster was Calcium Mineralogy in Forest Soil Profiles from three northeastern sites having a wide range in total calcium. Without apparently not having the authors here, does anyone want to make any comment on those posters for the group as a whole? Not those posters, but that poster, sorry. Where's Russ? Is he here? Russ had some comments on it. Russ Briggs? No, I don't see Russ out there. Anyone else? Well, from that, you know, it seemed that the soils of the, they had a soil in the Catskills, which was the lowest in calcium concentration, and one from Sleepers River, which had the highest calcium, and then Hubbard Brook was moderate. So they had a, and one thing is quite significant, seems to me that was quite significantly different there, was the difference in, of course, in the parent materials from those three sites. But since we don't have any questions and nobody really to answer those questions, Farah, you're on, baby. We'll take it away here. This is a tag team. Is that what they say in on TV wrestling?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next poster we had, I was actually a co-author on, very late in the author list, but first author was Ruth Yenai, and the title was, Is Phosphorus More Limiting Than Nitrogen in Young Northern Hardwood Forest? So first off, does anybody have any sort of initial responses, comments, or questions? So if you remember, in that poster, Ruth showed the use of a multi-element limitation model, which basically suggested co-limitation by nitrogen and phosphorus, and that limitation shifts from being more phosphorus to nitrogen during secondary succession. Do you all think that that's an accurate and applicable model for the northern hardwood system?
Like the opposite of the two, right? The phosphorus, the nitrogen is going to leave the system and the nitrogen.
I had a question. You mentioned a shift to the importance of nitrogen fixation as stands get older. And so what's the mechanism there? But in those systems, there aren't a lot of nitrogen fixers, right? Or is
early successional things tend to be nitrogen fixing? Then why would any ecosystem evolve or succeed to encase a situation where you don't have nitrogen fixers? Do they have nitrogen limited? So he addressed that question earlier, and the new one was to add phosphorus to the model, and he found that he couldn't get primary succession to grow a forest within 10,000 years after deglaciation. Unless he included a parallel, or he included a phosphorus weathering mechanism that the plant could decide to allocate carbon to weather phosphorus, or he could decide to allocate carbon to fixed nitrogen. So that's built in at the level necessary to keep forest.
Yeah, Dale.
Dale, I have a question for you. Is it really correct to say that the system is nitrogen limited? That seems to be more of a human value that we're placing on it for some particular use.
Let me rephrase it then. The growth response to added nitrogen is positive. Let me find that name.
Okay, I didn't mean to be picky with the question, but.
Be picky.
I wasn't mean to. Okay.
Yeah. Any other comments on that?
Could I ask one more? How do you think the mycorrhizal fungi would play into this?
Yeah, Lindsay.
I have a question for both Ruth and Sarah, because your talk and your poster were both dealing with nitrogen versus phosphorus limitation. And I guess my burning question deposition, in your best opinion, are the pores nitrogen limited, phosphorus limited, or both? Colonization.
Well, that's sort of why I started looking at these microbial processes, because I think certainly in the system that I'm working in, we don't see signs of phosphorus limitation, significant signs of phosphorus limitation if you look at retranslocation or foliar chemistry by itself. So I was thinking if there was any sort of phosphorus limitation, it might show up first in microbial processes and take a certain amount of time to sort of be seen back up in vegetation. But I think it's too early to tell from my data. What about Ruth?
I know Matt Vadebunker presented at the DSA meeting this summer a meta-analysis of nitrogen and phosphorus efficient experiment. I believe he did in Northeast. I'm sorry, I don't know. He's preparing it now for publication. Tune in next year. I know that there were some that showed a response to phosphorus because he showed that.
What about
okay, well, our next poster was by Dale Johnson and a suite of other authors, and it was called Hotspots and Hot Moments, Another Look at Nutrient Variability in Sierra Nevada Forest Soils. So Dale was kind of talking about this notion of these nutrient hotspots, particularly focused on nitrogen. Any comments about that poster?
I think Dale's poster highlights a point that we don't recognize very well, is that these forest ecosystems, the complexity of them, you know, we were just talking about N and P, why we're so surprised it's one or the other. Well, it just almost makes perfect sense. At times it's going to be nitrogen in some locations, in other forests it's going to be phosphorus, it's going to be copper some places, because those nutrients aren't distributed, you know, evenly across the ecosystem, and it highlights the need to understand that spatial and temporal complexity if we're going to understand these ecosystems. You know, and I think it really calls into question, you know, how have we sampled them? You know, we've talked about this before. You know, we sample here, but that's an anomalous sample. You know, I think Dale and I were talking, well, if you looked at his data and you were analyzing it and you just plotted it, and you had this one point out here, what would you do? Oh, that's an outlier. I must have contaminated the sample. I'm going to throw it out.
Yeah, you throw out the Job's tree spike.
Yep. And so, you know, and how do we know whether or not, you know, some disproportionate amount of the nutrients in the forest ecosystems aren't made available, you know, from these localized zones?
Right.
You know, probably the Romans knew that. Whoever invented sewers probably figured out where tree roots grow and feed.
Disproportionately.
You know, I mean, Eric Sucre did, you know, work a few years ago on decomposing roots and found, you know, disproportionate amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, fine root density, microbial populations, all in those zones. And we know when we sample, you know, when you sample and your sample spot hits a decomposing root, you're going to throw that sample out.
Okay, you don't throw it out. You make sure that you adequately sample the ecosystem, but that's not to dismiss this idea that microsites are important.
No, absolutely.
They're incredibly important.
They're absolutely important. You have to understand them, and we have to sample and figure out how to incorporate them into our analysis of ecosystem nutrient availability.
Well, one thing I think is that, and I didn't show this, but
Yeah.
I think this begs for a new analysis tool, because we're all slaves to statistics that says you have to put in a mean, a standard deviation, and then you have to compare the means, and if your variability is too big, either you go take 1,000 samples so that your standard deviation goes down, or you just say, I can't say anything conclusively. And so I think we have to turn this around and actually start talking to statisticians about developing new tools by which we can actually look at inherently messy data and find tools by which we can say, hey, this site is different from this site based on its extremes, not based on the average. And so that's where we need to go. We actually need to go to the development of new tools by which we look at our data. And we cannot do that with our little packages, you know, SysStat or SPSS or SAS if we're so inclined or what have you. It's actually talking to the people who are putting together the methodology.
I have talked to a couple of statisticians, David Turner, about how you identify, because I only found a few things, like extreme outliers, and they just get a blank stare. I don't know. I'm all here.
But yeah, I know in our university, one of the issues that they're working on is on how do you do monitoring for endangered and rare species when you have data sets with big holes in it and data sets with that are inherently messy. And we have the statistical users, but actually the developers of statistical tools working on it. That's where we got to go, not on the consultants, but actually people that make statistics there, or developing statistical tools there, their bread and butter. That's where we need to go.
Dan, did you? Oh, I think he had his hand up first. We'll go Dan and then Rob. Rob, did you still have something you wanted to say?
I was just going to mention about the idea of developing software. My wife is a biostatistician, and she works in the medical field. They're saddled somewhat with having to have a higher, confidence interval than we are, but there's a consortium they're developing now so they can start using meta-analysis in assessing health science kind of data. And it's a huge undertaking to develop the software to analyze that so it can be used in medical data sets. But that's the kind of thing we do need is the statistical software.
Okay, do we have one more comment and then we'll wrap it up?
I think the biggest bias we have, by the way, from my point of view, is the non-selecting of a site where a tree is. And clearly we all make sure that we avoid taking a sample where a tree is. That can be a significant percentage of your area. So if you want to get away from biases, I'd start with that one.
I don't believe you ever took soil samples from trees or trees. Start.
Okay, we're going to move on to discussion of the next couple posters.
Who's doing this, Lee? Thanks, Tom. Our next poster was Total Calcium in Forest Soils of Maine and West Virginia. A.B. Jenkins, Stephen Carpenter, John Sensendiver, and M.A. Wilson. Do we have any of the authors here? Don't see any. I'm doing really well. I like this, you know. It makes my job pretty easy, huh? Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's, I was born that way, Dale. Would anyone like to make any comments at all on that poster? Calcium in Maine and West Virginia. Does anyone have a good idea for me why the study was done in Maine and West Virginia? Oh, that's reason enough. That's reason enough. So we see there's more calcium in Maine than there is in West Virginia. Okay, well, good. I'm doing well. Let's go on to the next one. Next poster, number 1426, was losses of dissolved organic carbon and nitrogen across hardwood forests in Michigan. And we had Emily Scott and David Rothstein. Do we have either of those authors here?
Yeah, they didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. That's the one that was missing. It's all right. I got it. Yep. Let's, yeah, that's good. No wonder I don't have any notes on that one. Okay, so we go to 1427. Long-term changes in forest soils of Maine and Illinois. So we had Maine and West Virginia, now we're going to Maine and Illinois. We got some people who move around a lot, huh? Okay, all right. Yep. And so anyway, long-term changes in forest soils in Maine. And who has some questions or comments on that one? We have some of the authors here, I know.
Material, there's no secondary minerals.
Right.
And so we move it up, we expect carbon accumulation.
Any other questions for Mark? Comments for him? Okay, well, I get to do the last one as well. Boreal Mixedwood Watershed Riparian Zone Cation Cycling during two... That's what I was about to say. And Dan, do you want to follow up with anything from the session that you were on just earlier?
Ron, you and Farah did a great job. I don't have any more questions.
Farah did the work. Any others? Well, the bar is still there, folks. Okay, we'll wrap it up. Thank you.